Good morning, everybody. Our share this morning is entitled An Interpretation of an Unknown Manuscript of the Zohar. So what we're going to do this morning is we're actually going to study a little bit of Kabbalah. I'm going to give you a brief abstract of what we're going to do because it gets a little bit complicated, but it's not all that complicated. Just so that you can understand the beginning, the middle, and the end, and then we'll go through it. So essentially, we're looking at a manuscript that was discovered in the Vatican Library. This manuscript was a Zoharic text from the Zohar, the Jewish, one of the main Jewish works of mysticism. And in the story, in this manuscript, it tells a story of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Abba, who were going on a journey. Rabbi Yossi reprimands Rabbi Abba for not discussing Torah while they were traveling. You see, if you look at the style of Zoharic writing, many of the writings take place in the form of a story of rabbis traveling. Usually they're the Tanaim, the associates of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and they pass through various places, and as they travel, they discuss various things. So this image of these great rabbis walking and traveling through the countryside, studying Torah and explaining Torah, is quite a dominant theme in the Zohar. But the problem in our text, in our newly discovered text, is Rabbi Abba remained silent on the journey. Now, that's a no-no in Kabbalah or in the Zohar, because when you travel, you have to discuss Torah. It has various benefits. You cleanse the air around you. You do tikkunim, rectifications of the reality around you. And you're also protected. Traveling was always a dangerous enterprise and still is. But by studying Torah, you are protected from the dangers of the journey. So for Rabbi Abba to have kept quiet on this journey was out of the ordinary. And Rabbi Yossi reprimands him. He's actually angry at him. That's how our text opens. Eventually, Rabbi Abba responds that silence is a better path, a better path. Silence is a metaphor for kavanah, concentration, intent. In other words, what Rabbi Abba is trying to explain to Rabbi Yossi is that you don't need to do physical things to create spiritual consequences. In other words, you don't need to study Torah, to verbalize the Torah, to go through the motions, to draw down the energy, the protective energy. It will happen automatically if you simply have kavanah. You just need to think Torah. You don't need to say Torah. Now, this might seem like a minor concept or a minor idea, but it touches upon a very fundamental notion of Kabbalistic thought. Do the actions of the mitzvot, and it's not just talking Torah, it's putting on tefillin, it's doing anything. Is it the actions that one does? Do those actions draw down the energy, or is it the kavanah? The kavanah is the word that we're going to use throughout this shir. Is it the intent, the concentration, the mindfulness, the experientialism that you go through, that kavanah that draws down the energy? And obviously what's taking place in our story is a debate as to the role or over the role of kavanah in the mitzvot. Rabbi Yossi seems to believe that without speaking Torah in us, without actually doing the mitzvot, verbalizing, saying the Torah out loud, the benefit, the energy, the theurgy is not there. Whereas Rabbi Abba, who comes across as the more senior rabbi, Abba also means father, responds that you actually, yes, of course the mitzvot are important. Obviously, otherwise we wouldn't be Jewish and we wouldn't have this discussion. So no one's saying that the mitzvahs aren't important. But the essence is the kavanah. So he kept silent on the journey, evoking the kavanah aspect, emphasizing the aspect of kavanah. And he was trying to impress upon Rabbi Yossi that it's not just the mechanics of the mitzvot that benefit us, but it is the kavanah that sets the whole process into motion. But it seems, and this is the point of this whole text, it seems that Rabbi Abba's approach of silence, we're calling the approach silence, the approach of kavanah, and you know what that means now, as opposed to concentration on the nitty-gritty and the minutiae of the law. We call it the path of silence. The path of silence seems to have been quite a threatening notion to the Kabbalists at that time, because some of the schools of Kabbalah were becoming rather radical. And by radical, I'm meaning focused too much on Kabbalah with less of an emphasis on the actual physical mitzvot. So the more mainstream or the more traditional, the more conservative mystics in the period of the Zohar, whichever period it may have been, we're not going into that now, but the more conservative mystics were concerned that the essential role of the mitzvot, the minutiae of the law, is still maintained, whereas the more spiritual Kabbalists, as opposed to the mystical, we're going to make that distinction between the mystical Kabbalists, those are the Kabbalists who are into the theosophy and the theory of Kabbalah, but they're very much traditionalists. The role of the mitzvot and the minutiae of the law still play an important role. Those are the traditional mystical Kabbalists. Whereas we have a group that we're going to call the spiritual Kabbalists, who, again, they're not evading the halacha, but they are placing an inordinate amount of energy and focus on kavanah, on the experiential aspect and on the intent. It's the intent that triggers the response, not the actual mitzvot that trigger the response. And then we're going to look at the fact that there may have been these two schools, the mystics and the spiritualists, as we're going to call them. There may have been some kind of political tensions, and therefore some writings would have been censored and edited. And this may be one of the reasons why our text that we're going to look at never made it to the printed edition of the Zohar, because in our text, Rabbi Abba eventually convinces Rabbi Yossi, who reprimanded him in the beginning. Remember, he was angry that he wasn't speaking Torah, that he took the path of silence. In the end, Rabbi Yossi is brought around to the way of Rabbi Abba, and they both carry on walking in silence, with Rabbi Yossi understanding Rabbi Abba's view, you know, the spiritual Kabbalist's view, that kavanah is the most important prerequisite, not necessarily the mechanical performance of the mitzvot. Okay, so that's the entire shiur. So if you want to go now, we're not going to say much more than that, although there are quite a few interesting bits that we can add to this story. So, I based myself on the research of Professor Ronit Meroz. Continuation in a sense of some of the ideas that we spoke on about last week. So it turns out that at the time of this research, which was 2008, over 600. I think the exact number was 660 odd manuscripts were found of the Zohar that were not included in the Zohar. So already we see that there was a lot of writing, of Zoharic writings, that for some reason were not included in the corpus of the printed Kabbalah. Now our text, if you read our text without the explanation that we've just given, it seems like a very benign text. Two people are walking. One guy's upset that the other guy is not speaking Torah, and he's following a certain path. And eventually, the other guy convinces him, and off they go. Style is a very typical Zoharic style, and it's the kind of thing that one finds all the time in the Zohar. So there's nothing really stands out at first glance when it comes to this text. It doesn't seem like a subversive text. It doesn't seem as if it warranted having been censored or removed from the canon or not being printed or having consigned to remaining an unprinted and an unknown manuscript that found its home for many, many years in the Vatican. But in fact, there is a very fundamental debate that we see in this text of the Zohar, as I explained in the abstract in the beginning, a debate between the radical spiritual Kabbalists and the conservative mystical Kabbalists, and the whole debate over the role and function of mitzvot versus kavanah, which is dominant. Obviously, both of them had both of them. The conservatives still used Kavanah, and the spiritualists, radical spiritualists, still performed the mitzvot, but we're looking at the actual amount of focus on those various concepts. So when it came to the early Kabbalistic text, just to give a bit of background to how Kabbalah was written and how that corpus, that literature developed, and originally, the Zohar, even in manuscript form, remember, printing only came out in the mid-1400s. The Zohar, we know, was published in 1290. So in the 13th century, towards the end of the 13th century, the Zohar comes out for the first time, no matter who wrote it. That's when it came out. So it was presented for the first time in what's called choirs. These are, you know, if you open a book, you can sometimes see like little booklets within the bindings of the book. If you look from the side, these are called choirs. They're kind of sewn together. They're independent pieces, and then all the various choirs are joined together, and then that forms part of the book. If you page through a book, you can actually see quite distinctly where those choirs are. So the Zohar was first written, as many books were at that time, in manuscript form. And when they were sewn together, the manuscript became what's known as a codex, which is a book form, but not a printed book form. So when we use the word book, we kind of think of a printed book, but you can have a codex, which is a manuscript book. You just got lots of manuscripts sewn together, or various choirs sewn together. Choirs is spelt with a Q, by the way. All right. But it was distributed, and this is what's important for our purposes. The Zohar was distributed in these choirs. So it wasn't really distributed as a book. You know, today we know the Zohar is, it's got a couple of volumes, and it's a unit. But initially, it were groups of manuscripts or choirs or certain collections of writings, maybe one choir, maybe two or three sewn together, and that is how the Zohar was distributed. But what this means is that there was a loosely controlled way of determining which of these groups of papers or groups of writings or manuscripts got included into what later became known as the Zohar, because it was never presented one shot as one collection of writings, as one complete literature. It was done piecemeal and over many years. It was distributed in that way. So it was very easy for some writings simply to have missed being included in the official presentation of the Zohar, But it was also very, very easy for texts of the Zohar to be censored or simply eliminated. The copyists would simply not like certain things. They might have been aware of certain tensions within the Zoharic community at the time, and they would have left out certain things, and it would have been very easy for them to have done that, because in any case, there was not great organization in the early manuscript dissemination of the texts of the Zohar. So let's go back into our text. Let's start looking at our text. Remember, it's Rabbi Yossi who starts the ball rolling. He gets angry at Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba is the more senior rabbi. Rabbi Abba follows the path of silence. So it is Rabbi Yossi versus Rabbi Abba. In other words, it is the traditional conservative Kabbalist who challenges the more spiritual, radical Kabbalist, Rabbi Abba, who follows a path of silence, negating the importance of the actual pronunciation of the words, in other words, the actual performance of the mitzvot. Okay. But what this means is that this text, and it's actually MS Vatican 206 is its official name, this particular text is about, it is a debate about dveikut, dveikus. In modern Hebrew, devek is glue, dveikus. How do you glue yourself to God? How do you cling? How do you cling to God? How do you achieve the state of dveikus? Later, the Hasidic movement came and spoke and brought this concept back, but we're talking long before the Hasidic movement. So our discussion in this text is about how do you achieve dveikus? How do you achieve this communion with God? Do you do it through the mechanical performance of mitzvot? Or do you do it through a focus of the mind, which is called kavana? So do you achieve dveikut through performance of mitzvahs, or do you achieve it through dveikus, through kavana, experientialism, mindfulness? So Rabbi Yossi starts out, and he obviously is a convert of the former view that you need mitzvahs. He's a follower of the more conservative Kabbalists, that you need to fulfill the mitzvot. This new revolution in Jewish mysticism wasn't really a rebellion against the laws of the Torah. It was a deeper way of understanding those existent laws of the Torah, but understanding them through mystical eyes. So you still needed very much to keep to every halacha, and you needed to keep to all the requirements, the physical and halachic requirements of the Torah. So Rabbi Yossi starts out like that. And for that reason, he's angry at Rabbi Abba for not speaking the Torah. You know, in Kabbalah, it's like davening. You can't just open a siddur and quickly sight read, or just read it in your mind. You need to articulate the words, and you need to actually mouth and form the shape of the words, because by doing that, you're forming the shape of the letters, and you're actually, through your mouth, you are constricting energies and breath, and you're shaping spiritual entities. The same thing with Torah. You need to actually read it, and you need to say it, you need to explain it, someone needs to hear it. There has to be a dialogue for these energies to become active. So Rabbi Yossi starts off, he is a follower of that conservative school of Kabbalah, and he's upset that the senior person that he's traveling with doesn't necessarily hold that view, because he is not mouthing the words of the Torah, and he's not speaking and teaching Torah. He's in fact remaining silent. So what I've done is I've summarized this text, because it gets quite complicated. So I'm going to read you like a summary of the text. When I talk about we're going to do the text, we're doing a summary of the text, and it's my summary of the text. All right. So, line one, summary of line one of the text says, Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yossi are walking on the way. Okay, so that's fine. That's what we've said. We know they're both traveling together. It appears as if it's just the two of them. And now they've started their journey. And of course, Rabbi Yossi is waiting for Rabbi Abba, the senior rabbi, to start saying, you know, this week's parasha says, and give a whole explanation on something or other. Between line two and line five, we read the following. Rabbi Yossi suddenly becomes angry at Rabbi Abba and asks him why he was not speaking words of Torah, which was expected, especially in the style of the Zohar. And Rabbi Yossi said, you know, we're going on a long journey. The way is still long. We've got a lot of time to discuss so many things. Let's not waste it. We can achieve so much. We can do so much cleansing. We can do so many tikkunim. We can change the world. We can change the cosmos in our discussion. And yet you, Rabbi Abba, who should know better, are remaining silent. And also by speaking Torah, we would attach ourselves to God. So this wouldn't be considered just a journey in like chulin, just a secular activity. We can turn it through speaking Torah. We can turn it into a religious and spiritual event. But Rabbi Abba is silent. He is not giving any votes on anything. Okay, now let's pause here in the text because I want to go now into a couple of examples from the Zohar in general that speak about this very idea, which will explain where Rabbi Yossi was getting upset because it was such a common idea in the Zohar. And it also showed that Rabbi Abba's keeping silent was subversive in that particular culture. Now I'm going to give you three examples just from regular Zohar to show the importance of speaking Torah on a journey. By the way, today you have many people who have books in their cars and they especially have svarim in their cars so that when you're on a journey, even though you need to keep your eyes on the road, you've still got the books of Torah which will offer you and afford you protection during the journey. But that's sort of a modern day spin off of this ancient idea. But in the Zohar, we do find such a thing. So in Zohar, volume 1, 6, we read the following. Anav Atun Nazil says, let each of us walk. This got nothing to do with our text. This is just from the Zohar in general. So says the Zohar, me and you, Nazil, we'll go on a journey, Brit Asek Boraita, and we will discuss Torah. So this again shows the notion of that journeying was always equated with an opportunity to study Torah. They would walk and talk. And that's exactly what he says. Come, my friend, come with me on a journey. We'll go for a walk. It doesn't have to be a journey for days or weeks or months, maybe even for a couple of hours. We go for a walk. And we're not going to sit in the base midrash. We're going to walk. We're going to walk and talk Torah. And each of us will have a chance to say words of wisdom. And why are we going to do this? And these are the operative last two words of this text. It says, La'anhara orcha, to light up the way, to light up the way, the path. The outside world. We need to bring this light to the outside. La anhara orcha. We need to light up the way. We don't want to just be locked in a room. We want to light up the world. And by going out into the field and speaking Torah, that's a concept in the Zohar. Inviting someone to come on a journey, dafka, to study Torah. So we can see that this is something that was expected. It was part of the very genre, the very essence of this style of teaching. The second story that I'm going to bring to you is from the Zohar 2:36, and that says as follows. Someone here, Rabbi Yossi, actually it's the same Rabbi Yossi, he's complaining to another rabbi, Rabbi Chia in this case, not Rabbi Abba in this case. He's complaining that Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Yossi, both of them were walking, but Rabbi Chia wasn't interested in speaking Torah either. Seems that Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Abba were from the same school. But it's a different text. It's not our text. So Rabbi Yossi says, Am I at Shatik? Why are you silent? Very similar to our text. It's like a sister text. He's saying to Rabbi Chiya, why are you silent? It's a very interesting text. Why are you quiet? Ha'ucha, surely through a journey or on our journey, lo it taken ela b'mili doraita. We won't be able to fix anything. We won't be able to do a tikkun, to rectify anything, ela b'mili doraita, unless we discuss words of the Torah. Not think words, but we need to mouth the words. Why are you shatik? Why are you quiet? We need to say these words out loud. We need to articulate them. Because otherwise we're not going to be a tikkun. Our Torah is not going to save the world or save the cosmos or affect the cosmos in any way. So that's another text. And that's nice because that includes Rabbi Yossi as well, who has the same objection to another walk that he did with another participant, Rabbi Chiya, instead of our text, which he's speaking about, Rabbi Abba. Okay. The third story, once again emphasizing the same idea, just to show you that this was very much part of what was expected of a Kabbalist in those times. This time, neither participant in the story speaking, the narrator, we hear the voice of the narrator. And the voice of the narrator, instead of Rabbi Yossi, is now angry that the one person is not speaking Torah on the journey. It's now the narrator becoming cross. Rabbi Yossi set off on a journey, this time with Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov. Rabbi Yossi went on lots of journeys. Okay? So far, we've seen three people who he's traveled with. In this case, he's now traveling not with Rabbi Abba, not with Rabbi Chiya, but he's now traveling with Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov. That's our third case. He's walking with him. And as they're walking, in this case, Rabbi Yossi became silent. And he thought of worldly matters. Okay, so in this case, he, for whatever reason, wasn't speaking, he was silent. And he was thinking about worldly matters. His mind was wandering. But Rabbi Achar bar Yaakov was studying Torah, but only in his mind. In this story, his traveling partner is thinking Torah, but Rabbi Yossi himself is keeping quiet. And the narrator is now angry at both of them, angry at Rabbi Yossi for not doing Torah at all, because he's thinking about something else. Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov, the narrator, is angry at him. He's thinking about Torah, but he's not speaking it out loud. So the narrator is angry at both of them because they're on a journey and neither of them are speaking Torah. Okay, so there we see three examples from the Zohar, how important it is to walk the talk, as Shmonya says. All right. Now let's go back to our text. Obviously, Rabbi Abba is aware of these Zoharic texts because he's a participant in all those three texts. So he's obviously aware that the narrator is angry at him. He's angry at the other people. He's obviously aware very much of the need to discuss Torah. And he's also aware of the fact that in one case he wasn't thinking anything and then he got rebuked for it. So he is very conscious of walking and talking Torah. But now the story begins to change, and now we can see how the story becomes an extremely significant story. Now, just bear with me. I'm going to make it as simple as I can. It's a very complicated idea, but it's not terrible, not terribly complicated. Rabbi Abba is aware. There's an undertone over here that Rabbi Abba knows something. He knows some secret that Rabbi Yossi doesn't know. And he knows that the secret is far superior to what Rabbi Yossi knows. It's an ancient path. Rabbi Abba, again, the senior Abba father, the senior person knowing the ancient path. That's how you can remember it. That's the imagery over here. So Rabbi Abba is very conscious that he's following not a new Zoharic path of the 13th century or whatever. He's following a path that's far more ancient, going back beyond the Tanaim and going back to the biblical period. And he's trying to say that in the time of the Torah, in the time of the Tanakh, Maybe even before the mitzvahs were given, or in the Tanakh, the Torah already was given, but the rabbinic Judaism hadn't developed to the state that it developed in the time of the Tanaim. So he's going back to the roots of Judaism, where one achieved communion with God through kavanah, not through deeds, because, you know, there's a story of Yaakov peeling sticks. He didn't have tefillin, so when he peeled sticks, Kabbalah wax is quite lyrical when it comes to that. He fulfilled what we now fulfill with halachic tefillin and leather straps. But he didn't have leather straps because tefillin hadn't yet been given, so he peeled bark and sticks. Pitzalot, he was peeling them. In the original formulation of Judaism, the emphasis wasn't on mitzvot, it was on kavanah. That's the point. And Rabbi Abba wants to link back to this earlier form of worship of God where the mitzvahs didn't get in the way. And again, no one's negating the importance of mitzvahs, because otherwise, as I said before, we wouldn't be Jewish and wouldn't be having this discussion. So mitzvahs are important, no one's saying they're not. But he's emphasizing the idea of the importance of kavanah, and he's claiming that this was the essence of Judaism, and therefore we need to bring it back, because maybe we're placing too much emphasis on the mechanics. So he wants to bring back this experientialism, this notion of kavanah. So Rabbi Abba is now going to explain how mitzvot were kept. How mitzvot were kept before the technical mitzvahs were given, how they were performed in the space of kavanah, not in the space of daladamas, not in the constricted space of the minutiae of the law. He says we need to draw back down that energy. By the way, the Hasidic movement that came tried to do the same thing. But this is what was happening at the time of the Zohar. And Rabbi Abba is of that school. He wants to bring that practice back. So Rabbi Abba writes, and this is in between lines 6 and 7 in our text, he says, Rabbi Abba responded that times have changed. In earlier periods, the people were proficient in Torah and even women were scholars. Let me explain what he means here now. He says, going back to the ancient wisdom where kavanah played this predominant role, even women knew then what men now in the imagined generation or in the real generation of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, whichever school of thought you want to take when it comes to the age of the Zohar, even in the generation of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, men don't know. So what he's saying is, he says, even the great Tanaim in the generation of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai do not know the real secret of Judaism from the biblical period, that even women, ordinary women in the street, used to know in earlier days. In other words, about the importance of kavanah, not the minutiae of the law, but the broadness and experientialism and the concentration and mindfulness and the intent of the law. That's what needs to be focused on. We need to know why we're doing it, not so much on how to do what we do. And this was an ancient wisdom. We've lost it. We now focus on the how, not on the why. So he's, in fact, insulting his generation. He's, in fact, insulting the entire generation of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, because he says the women then were better than the men now. They understood these things that men today don't understand. Men have gone off track because the scholars were all men, not too many women scholars in those days. But these great men, they've lost track. They're focusing too much on mouthing the words of Torah and saying this and waiting for certain things to happen as a result of their contribution to the cosmos, instead of really focusing on what's necessary, which is the actual kavanah. So now Rabbi Abba goes, and he's going to take us now into a fascinating journey. It's a very unusual, and I must warn you, it's a rather strange journey into the mind of pre-rabbinic Judaism, going back into how during the time of the Tanakh. We're going to look specifically at the book of Ruth here now for a moment, and I'll try to make it as simple as possible to see how kavanah, to see how we conducted ourselves when our religion was a religion on of kavana more than of minutiae. So going back to the notion of the ancient women understanding more than the men of his days, understanding the importance of kavana, Rabbi Abba says, we need to look at the yibum. The yibum. What's the yibum? Yibum in English is a levirate marriage. Levir in Latin means brother-in-law. So what's the story? You have a man and a woman who get married. The husband dies before he produces a child, a son. He dies childless. So the Torah tells us that the wife, the widow, should marry the brother of the deceased husband to perpetuate his name and his family name so that the brother and the brother's potential is not lost to future generations. So the widow does yibum. She gets married to her late husband's brother. This is something that's referenced in the Torah, and it's called yibum, yibum, the levirate marriage. Okay, so the husband dies, the widow goes to the late husband's brother, and when they have a child, that child then perpetuates the family name as it's simply understood, the name of the brother. And everyone remembers the brother. So the brother didn't die without having children. Now, Rabbi Abba is going to explain this concept in mysticism. And here we really, really go into a very, very interesting piece of Kabbalah, a piece of mysticism that is real mysticism. According to the Zohar now, this is Zoharic mysticism now. According to the Zohar, it's not just, the Yibum is not just to perpetuate the memory and the name and the family name of the brother, so you call him by the same name or so that you remember the deceased brother. It's not like that at all. It's not like that. That might be included, but that's not what it's about. It's far, far deeper. The Zohar explains, and he has an astounding concept. Strange concept, but a fascinating concept, quite a disturbing concept in a way. The widow who marries her deceased husband's brother, according to the Zohar, is no longer just the wife, the new wife of the brother, of the deceased husband. She becomes what's known as itete ime. She becomes a wife, because she is a wife. She gets remarried, so she's now a wife to the brother. But she also becomes the mother. The mother to whom? The mother, listen to this, the mother of her late husband. So, the wife of the deceased husband gets remarried. She was the wife to the first husband. She's now the wife to the brother. So she's still a wife. She's a wife now to two men. One was alive. One is alive. One was dead. But she fulfilled the role of a wife twice. But she also becomes ime. She becomes the wife mother. Itute ime. The wife mother of the deceased brother. How does she do that? Because she causes her deceased husband to come alive again, and she births him. So she gives birth, according to the Zohar, to her deceased husband. What's happening now is beyond a reincarnation. It's a coming back to life. She brings her deceased husband back to life again by assuming the role of wife mother. She's the widowed wife of her late husband, but she now becomes the mother of her late husband as he gets reborn as her child through the brother, which means that the brother, the new husband, becomes the husband of his brother, becomes the husband to the widow, the new husband, but the brother but the brother becomes the father of his deceased brother. Just wrap your head around that. So the Zohar says, just to show that I'm not making this up, this is Zohar 3, and it's actually page 100, so it's quite a central page in the Zohar. It says, his deceased brother's wife, that's the widow, becomes his mother, becomes the deceased husband's mother. So she's the wife mother. I won't say an ex-wife, but she's the widowed wife, and now the mother of the same husband. And the brother that she now marries becomes his father, becomes his brother's father. Now, Adam, if you've just joined us now in your spaceship, I suggest you go back to sleep because you've just missed everything, and I'm not going to explain this again. But you'll have to. All right. If you understand what we're saying from now, Adam, then kudos to you. All right, so here we have this amazing idea of bringing back the soul of a dead person through a mother and a father who once the father was a brother and the mother was a wife, and the wife is becoming the mother of the ex-husband, and she marries the father. Of the brother, who's the brother of the brother. Okay. So, this is the secret of Yibum. Now, let's not get too lost in the story, because it's a very strange story by any standards. But in a sense, it's a typical Kabbalistic story. These things happen in Kabbalah. Let's relate this to our particular context of here, because that's what's important. Rabbi Abba emphasizes that the brother, besides the new brother, the surviving brother, besides being the husband of his brother when he gets reborn in the new marriage, is called in Ruth 4:1, they refer to the brother as Hagoel, the redeemer. So he redeems the brother. And of course, in Pashtus, in the simple sense, he's redeeming his brother because he's perpetuating the brother's name. This is how we explain it to kids today when we teach them about a Yibum. You're just carrying on the family name. We don't give them all these details over here about the Itita Ime, the wife mother, and the brother becoming the father of the brother again. And the wife becoming the mother of the ex of the deceased husband again, so she was his wife and his mother. We don't go into all those details. We refer to, okay, so now the new husband's the goyel, he's saving, he's redeeming the brothers, he's great, he's, it's like naming someone after someone who passed away. It's a wonderful thing because you can now remember them. We don't go into the actual technicality, the mystical technicalities. But of course the Kabbalists do. So why is he called Hagoel? Why is he called the redeemer? Because he's the redeemer, because he brings the brother, the dead brother, back alive again. He brings up that brother, becomes, it's not just a reincarnation. It's the deepest form of reincarnation, because he actually comes back. He comes back, and that's why he's called the Goyel, because he's redeemed the brother and brought him back. But Rabbi Abba now explains. So let's look at the case of Ruth. In the case of Ruth, Ruth was married to her husband. Her husband died without having a son in the biblical story of Ruth. So she did Yibum, wasn't on her late husband's brother, but it was on like someone else who was close in the family, an old man called Boaz. And they have a child, and that child is called Oved. And of course, Oved gives birth to Yishai. Well, he doesn't give birth. He's a father of Yishai. Yishai becomes the father of King David. David ben Yishai. So these are quite important people, and David becomes the father of the Messiah. So these are this important link. You're bringing back people who forming important roles in Jewish destiny and history. But it's achieved through the Yibum in Kabbalistic terms. But for our purposes, the child of the Yibum, the fruit of that Yibum, is called Oved. Oved in Aramaic is Avad, which means to do, to achieve something. Rabbi Abba explains that the only way you can bring back the deceased brother completely through the mother and the father, assuming all those different roles, is if you have Kavanah. This is the crux. This is the essence. This is now the pivot of our entire story. It doesn't happen by just marrying, by just fulfilling the mitzvah of Yibum. By fulfilling the mitzvah of Yibum, okay, good, Baruch Hashem, now you perpetuate the family name, and everything exists in its simple form. But if you really want to bring that person back the way the Zohar understands the potential of this particular union, it will not work if you just do the deed. If that marriage takes place, and that's all that happens, and a child is born, it's wonderful for the brother's memory, but it's not the brother. The only way you can bring the brother back into this reality is if you have Kavanah. So the crucial ingredient in this entire conceptualization is Kavanah. It's not just the marriage, it's the Kavanah. And Oved signifies that the way you get this thing done is through the intent and the Kavanah. And now there's a bit of a play on words here that's thrown in. According to the Zohar, if a man dies without producing a son, it's not just unfortunate. I know these are difficult concepts to speak about in the modern world, especially in these times. But anyway, we to be speaking about it because we're studying a little bit of Kabbalah now. If a man passes away before he has a son, he is guilty of a sin. Not necessarily he's doing, but doesn't matter. According to the Zohar, he gets punished. He gets sent to the lowest place in Gehinnom, the lowest place in hell, which is called Avadon. And Avadon is connected to the word Oved. In other words, that child, instead of the child of the Yibum, is redeemed, literally redeemed from going from the father having to go to Avadon. And a real redemption has taken place. But this can only happen if you have Kavanah. The deed alone is not sufficient. So you can see that the underlying theme over here is that let's take Yibum as an exemplar of mitzvot in general. Rabbi Abba is saying it's all very well that you're keeping the mitzvahs and putting on tefillin and walking and talking Torah. It's all very well. We fulfill the mechanics, but we're not going to really do anything of great significance. We're not going to be able to change the cosmos without intent, without Kavanah. Because every spiritual enterprise, in fact, is a kind of Yibum. So you're drawing down energies and you're making a difference and you're redeeming and you're fixing the world. But it won't happen just by doing the deed. The deed is important. The mitzvah is important. But it's more important, the Kavanah. And this is the message. This is the message of this text. A very, very deep message emphasizing the importance, not of speaking Torah, but of the path of silence, to emphasize that you from the school that believes in doing all the mechanics of the law, all the minutiae of the law, and that through that you find redemption, it's not going to work because those deeds are important. You need to do the deeds for the redemption. But what brings out the ultimate, in other words, we don't just perpetuate the name of the brother, but you bring the brother back. So you draw down the deepest of the energies. You save him from Avadon, from the nethermost aspects of the pit. You're able to salvage something. This change in the cosmos can only be brought about through Kavana. And therefore, I choose the path of silence, says Rabbi Abba. I'm not going to speak Torah because that's just the act. I want to really, really make a difference. And therefore, I'm focusing on Kavana. Now, to rub salt into the wound, Rabbi Abba goes on, and now these are lines 6 to 18 in our text. Rabbi Abba says, this is the deep and hidden meaning of Yibum. So he's just explained. This is what Yibum really means. It's not just a physical act. It's not just to perpetuate the memory of the brother. It's changing. It's changing the cosmos. When Rabbi Yossi hears that, he suddenly switches over to the view of Rabbi Abba, who now becomes his teacher. And he leaves the school of the mystical Kabbalists and he joins the school of the spiritual Kabbalists. And he turns around and he says, I understand now why you keep quiet, because you're emphasizing Kavana over the deed, over the articulations, over the saying of Torah. It's more the thinking. It's the Kavanah. And he says, happy is the portion of Israel, for they have the Holy Torah to understand higher secrets. So he says, you know, Ashreinu matov chalkeinu, happy are we that we understand these higher secrets. What I was starting to say before I got a little bit sidetracked was that Rabbi Abba rubbed salt into the wound by saying that this idea, this very deep idea of the Yibum, was something that was understood by the woman. Because when the Book of Ruth frames this story of the Yibum, it speaks about the woman speaking to Naomi, who raised the child, etc. It's talking about the woman. So the woman understood this. Even the woman understood this. Whereas today, in the generation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, whichever generation it was, even the great sages, men, do not understand it. So that is how he was rubbing salt into the wound, to saying even women knew this concept in times gone by, and we need to go back to that very deep understanding of the Torah. Okay, now just to start closing off quickly, I just want to mention that. So we've said that Rabbi Yossi was finally converted to the way of Rabbi Abba. So he became a spiritual Kabbalist and he left the school of mystical Kabbalists. One of the ways that he was able to do that was that these words of Rabbi Abba were not unique to Rabbi Abba. He would have also have heard them before from normal Zohar, like I gave examples of normal Zohar before, talking about the importance of speaking Torah on a journey. There was normal Zohar, you know, texts of the Zohar that got incorporated into the corpus of Kabbalah that spoke about ideas like Kavana. There are lots of ideas floating, like the Gemara. There's lots of ideas floating around. The main school of the Zohar might not have adopted the approach that Kavana was of the essence, but those ideas were still in the Zohar that spoke about Kavana being the essence. So let me give you two quick examples of the Zohar itself acknowledging the fact that the superior path is the path of silence, is the path of Kavana, even though the majority of the rabbis of the Zohar from the mystical school would not have subscribed to this. They would have regarded this as too radical, as belonging to the school of the spiritual Kabbalists, but it's still included in the printed Zohar. So here's one example. The Zohar says, this is now a Zohar that's speaking about Yibum. It's talking about Yibum. It wasn't an invention of Rabbi Abba on the journey. Rabbi Abba was actually basing himself on a standard text in the Zohar, but he was just emphasizing that school. So this now is the same idea, but from a standard text in the Zohar, just to show that Rabbi Abba wasn't being that subversive. So the Torah says, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside of the family. This is a verse from Dvarim. But her husband's brother will marry her, and they will have a child. But now the Zohar is commenting over here, and the Zohar is saying exactly the same thing as Rabbi Abba says in our subversive text. He says, here the Zohar now says, thought and will must be applied. Thought and will. You know, it's not just the act of the Yibum marriage. You need to have Kavanah. He's saying exactly the same thing as Rabbi Abba was saying, but this is in standard text. Because thought, and through thought and will, the necessary deeds are affected. In other words, the magic only happens. We bring the child, the brother back alive again. The great effects can only take place through thought and through will. Not just through the deed. In other words, you need to have, the Zohar is emphasizing that you need Kavanah. And then the Zohar quotes a verse from Iyov. It's so interesting. It's funny how you're able to take ideas out of context and then relate them to these very, very deep ideas. There's a verse in Iyov, and I don't get too complicated. It says, if he sets his heart upon him, he will gather him to his spirit and to his soul. Now, obviously, that's taken a certain concept in Iyov, but the Zohar is using it. If he sets his heart in arms, if the brother who now does the Yibum sets his heart, he will draw the soul to his soul. You know, he'll draw the soul of his late brother to his soul. He'll bring his brother back alive again. So the Zohar finds like an asmachta in a posuk in Iyov for this idea. And this is a standard text in the Zohar showing the importance of Kavanah. But obviously this wasn't the school that the Zohar wanted to perpetuate, because the Zohar wanted to do away with the emphasis on Kabbalah, on Kavanah, and move more towards the a marrying between Kavanah and Mitzvot, not on the superiority of Kavanah. The second normative source in the Zohar is very short. It says, "Kol milin de alma azlin bata machshava vehirhura." All things happen in the world. All things of importance that happen in the world only happen through machshava and hirhur, through thought, in our words, through concentration, through mindfulness, through kavanah. So if you really want to make an effect with the mitzvahs, it's not just the mitzvah, it is kavanah. So these are two examples from mainstream Kabbalah, but the general gist of Kabbalah went against these examples, even though you find it in the Zohar, because they were worried that these ideas were considered too radical, because they seem to sideline the importance of mitzvot. And Kabbalah was very conscious of the fact that it needed to be accepted by the Jewish world and had to come across as normative as possible. So it often tried to shield the normal populace from these very radical ideas. But the spiritual Kabbalists within the Zohar, those schools were emphasizing these ideas, and Rabbi Abba had done the same thing. But the problem with Rabbi Abba is that he convinced Rabbi Yossi. So to conclude this whole story, what is extremely subversive about this text is you can see that if it is true that there were these two schools, and Meros shows at the beginning of the 13th century, in other words, just before the Zohar was published, there were these schools of spiritual Kabbalists, you know, these radical spiritual Kabbalists who believed that the essence is Kavanah, and then there were the mainstream mystical, because of course they were mystical because they were Kabbalists, but they were the mainstreamers. They still believed in the importance of mitzvahs, and they certainly would want to sell Kabbalah to the masses by saying, we're not telling you to give up on the mitzvot and to just go spiritual path. You still do it, but now you marry the mitzvah and the kavanah, whereas the spiritualists were more interested in emphasizing the kavanah. But now in this text, we see Rabbi Abba does two terrible things. Number one, he insults the rabbis of the generation of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, as the story is conceptualized as taking place within that genre, within that time period. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But he's still insulting basically the Tanaim, the rabbis of the second century Mishnah period. He's insulting them because he says, the woman knew much more than you guys have got it a little bit wrong. As great as you think you are. So he's insulting them. That's number one reason why this text should have not been published. And the other reason is that the text emphasizes that the school of the practical Kabbalists is gaining hold. They're getting converts. They're getting followers. The great Rabbi Yossi, who was angry that people weren't going through the practical expressions of the mitzvot, and that he was angry that they were keeping quiet, that they were focusing on Kavanah. He now is won over after he hears this interpretation of Yibum, which he would have already been aware of before, but it was probably put across much more succinctly through the explanation of Rabbi Abba, explaining this idea that the essence has to be the Kavanah, not the deed, not the performance of the mitzvah, but the Kavanah is what brings down the magic. Rabbi Yossi now became a convert to that school and apparently shifted from the mystical Kabbalistic school to the spiritualist Kabbalistic school, the more radical school, where the purpose of the physical performance of the mitzvah and the pronunciation of the actual words was not so important. It was more the Kavanah. So I think that we will stop here. Really, I found this very interesting. First of all, a lovely journey into Kabbalistic thought to show some of the ideas that Kabbalah actually speaks about, because usually Kabbalah is just presented as this wonderful spiritual experience that one can have. But you look at ideas like husband becoming a father and a wife and a mother to a deceased husband, it's a very raw literature. And also that there were two different schools, a radical spiritual school and a more conservative mystical school, and how these tensions come out in a simple story. I think there's something like 28 odd lines, something like that. 26 lines, I think, in the entire story. It's a short story, and it looks like nothing. It looks like a normal story in the Kabbalah, yet with understanding of what was going on at the time that the Zohar was being published, understanding how the texts were disseminated through the choirs. It was very easy to sideline a particular text and make sure that a text did not get published. And until recently, we would never have known about this particular text had it not been for the discovery of MS-206 in the Vatican Library. I thank you so much for listening and look forward to seeing you again next time.